I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Today, it's Midday on Music with Maestro Maren Alsop, the music director of the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra, and Peter Chomey, who is completing his first year as the president and CEO of the BSO. In recent years, the orchestra has extended its reach into the community with its acclaimed Orchids program, collaborative ventures with organizations like the Baltimore Museum of Art and the Peabody Institute, and a repertoire that now includes rock bands and hip-hop artists. The BSO is by far the state's largest arts organization. Can it be the most relevant? Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews Inherit the Wind, the current offering at Baltimore's Vagabond Players. Midday on Music with Maren Alsop and Peter Chomey. They're up next when Midday gets underway right after these headlines. Good afternoon, everybody. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. We're listening to some music of Claude Debussy, La Mer, the sea. It's on the bill this weekend at the Meyerhoff in Baltimore and at Strathmore Hall in Bethesda when the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra teams up with the Baltimore Museum of Art to present music of Ravel and Debussy, two masters of Impressionism. This weekend's fair also includes a new hip-hop version of Carnival of the Animals and a piece by Baltimore native Philip Glass for two timpanists and orchestra. So there's something for everybody. And certainly making the BSO as accessible and appealing as it can be has been something that music director Maren Alsop has been working hard at since she began her historic tenure as music director in 2007. Today, it's Midday on Music with the maestra herself. Maren Alsop joins me in Studio A. Good to see you.
Great to be here, Tom.
And also joining us is Peter Chomey. He was appointed the president and CEO of the BSO just about a year ago. Peter, welcome to Baltimore and welcome to Midday.
Oh, thank you. Great to be here.
And if you'd like to join our conversation, you can find us at 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. And thanks to our good buddy, Jamila Krimple. We are streaming live on the WYPR Facebook page. So, Maren, let's talk about this weekend, first of all. French music, the importance of programming can't be understated. That's a big part of your job. People know you, obviously, because they see you conduct the shows, but there's an awful lot of thought that goes into what's actually going to be on each of those shows.
Oh, sure, but I think that's the real fun part of being a music director is to dream up programs and how they fit together and try to create a compelling experience for our listeners and for our musicians.
So tell us what's on the bill tonight.
Well, tonight will be it's part of our off-the-cuff series where I take a piece apart and talk about the backstory of the piece, give a little dirt on the composer, you know, kind of the gossip and whatnot.
I love gossip. Gossip. Nothing better.
Nothing better, really. And then we put the piece back together and perform it for the audience. But tonight it's going to be a little different and more of an enhanced experience because we have Katie Rothkopf from the Baltimore Museum of Art will be joining me in talking about some of the incredible images from their beautiful Impressionist collection. And we have one of the leading collections right here in Baltimore.
Sure.
So it's nice for people who perhaps don't frequent the museum to gain an awareness of this incredible art that's right down the block. And also trying to talk about the similarities between the Impressionist visual movement and the musical movement as well. So things like color and texture and timing and proportion and subject matter. I'm trying to draw parallels between the two worlds, and Katie's helping me with that. So, but between us, we could speak for many, many hours. So I'm just trying to keep us both on track time-wise.
Yeah, but Peter Chomey, I mean, this combination of the visual experience and the oral experience when you're hearing the orchestra play live at the Meyerhoff, seeing these images from the collection at the BMA, it's kind of like gone are the days, it seems, where people expect to just sort of come in and sit back and luxuriate in the sound. I mean, the experience of a concert has evolved, has it not? You've been in the business as a player and as an administrator now for a long time. It's not the same thing. This ain't your grandfather's Oldsmobile, as they
used to say. Absolutely true. It has evolved a great deal. And collaborations like this with the BMA and seeing images from the Cone Collection are a great way to enrich the experience. And we've taken other steps, like performing with movies and enriching the whole concert experience before and after the concert. When we talk with people in their 20s and 30s about what they are interested in, it's not only what's happening on the stage, but it's also that complete experience. What are those social experiences? What can we do to help enrich their lives for that entire evening? Mm-hmm.
Tell me a little bit, Marin, about a new version of Carnival of the Animals that you've dreamed up. This is not happening tonight, I guess, on off camera.
No,
it's going to happen tomorrow.
We did it last night, mm-hmm. and we'll perform this version again on Sunday afternoon at Strathmore. So the way this came about was I approached Rita Becker, who everyone knows was
long-time
the
narrator
for the symphony for over four decades. And I said, oh, Rita, and she's one of my best friends. I said, Rita, would you like to narrate something, maybe Carnival of the Animals? And she said, oh, you know, of course I'd love to. She said, but, you know, that narration is a little bit old and stale, the Ogden Nash, you know. She said, it sounds so dated. You really should do, a hip-hop version. And this was Rita's idea, and through various sources, we found a local artist here named Wordsmith, who's fantastic, and he wrote his own sort of hip-hop narration. It's, a la Hamilton and that approach. And I mean, he's just so marvelous. It's so creative. But last night, seeing him in his tails, he rented his tails. He looked so handsome, didn't he?
Yes.
And he was so at ease on this stage with this orchestra, something he'd never done before. And the audience went wild,
They
loved it.
And it was clear that Wordsmith was just delighted to be doing this. Yeah. That showed.
Yeah.
It was wonderful.
So now I think I'm going to have hip-hop narration for everything.
Yeah,
that's my
good.
New thing.
That's it.
Hip-hop narration all the time.
That's right. Mahler second, and here's some
hip-hop. Exactly.
The second symphony, the Resurrection Symphony. There's a little hip-hop thing on the Resurrection
Exactly.
Symphony.
Well, it's been so such a pleasure. I think I would enjoy that every time.
Peter, I mean, you came to Baltimore to take over the reins as the head administrator here at the orchestra from Grand Rapids, Michigan. As I mentioned, you were a player for a long time, an oboe player, worked at various different places. What's your impression? You've been here almost a year now. We like to say, those of us who've been here forever like to think, Baltimore is very quirky and funky and different and eccentric. Has that been your impression as well?
Oh, it's a remarkable city. And my first visit here was in June 2016 when the BSO was hosting the National League of American Orchestras Conference.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was one of the managers here in town. We were staying in Harbor East. I thought, well, this is what a beautiful city this is. I'm seeing these incredible investments that have been made in our city. And that night went to the Meyerhof to hear the BSO live for the first time. And it was not only hearing Marin lead the orchestra, but then seeing dancers from the Baltimore School of the Arts collaborating with us on Copeland's Appalachian Spring. And at the end, if that wasn't enough, children from Orc Kids came out and performed. That showed me that the BSO is working to be integral and indispensable to our community. And that made me want to come to Baltimore and be part of the BSO family. And it's really a wonderful city. One of the things that's been on my mind recently and thinking about some of what's been in the news is that sometimes I think that we focus maybe more than we have to on the problems. And I hope that we can try to focus the conversation also on the incredible assets that we have. We've been talking about the BMA, we have the Walters, the BSO, so many great cultural institutions. But the spirit of the city is very, very special. I've lived in the Midwest most of my life, and I had friends who said, oh, I don't know how you're going to handle going to the East Coast, Peter. That might be just too much for you. And it is such a warm and welcoming city. There is a very special spirit here. And those who've been here for decades may not realize mm-hmm. what we have. It's a very it's a beautiful place, and the state of Maryland also. I mean, we've spent a lot of time in Montgomery County and other Baltimore County and other places in the state. It's really a privilege to be here.
And Marion, I mean, you've been here, I guess, 11, 12 years now. Mm-hmm. At this point, mm-hmm. I've been here, I forget exactly when I showed up, somewhere right after the Civil War, I think. And, you know, we've talked for years about the importance of arts institutions when I was running the Baltimore Choral mm-hmm. Arts Society. And we've talked with, you know, our friends Julia Marchare Alexander at the Walters and Kwame Kwayarma at Center Stage about making arts institutions relevant to our community, a community that does have a lot of problems, does have a lot of challenges, but as Peter says, also has a lot of incredible assets. But I mean, as your time here has progressed over these 10 or 11 years, I mean, is the notion of relevance of an arts institution changing in your mind? I mean, is it evolving at all? What does relevance mean to you?
Well, I think relevance is about access and inclusion. And art should not be for a select group of people, and it shouldn't be limited just to those with the economic capacity to experience it. I think art is a human right, and everybody should have the equal access. And I think that at the Baltimore Symphony, I see it in many of the arts institutions here, I think there's not only a realization of that fact, but an embracing of that fact, so that we're trying to create an open door policy for people to experience art or for children to learn a musical instrument. And I have to say, last night on the intermission, I went out to visit with an audience member, and my greatest joy was to see three of our orchids who started when they were maybe 6-7 years old, and they're now in high school and extremely tall and handsome, three young men. And they were, you know, talking with Wordsmith there in the lobby and talking about what a great job he did and how much they enjoyed the percussion concerto, the timpani. And I thought, you know, this just feels right
now. That's the whole thing. Yeah. But Peter, I mean, as the person who's in charge of balancing the books, it ain't easy, because accessibility is something that we've talked about for years in arts organizations. But the fact of the matter is, to go to the BSO, to go to the Center Stage, to go to some of these events, it's pricey. I mean, so there is a price point. There's a barrier to a lot of people because it has to be pricey in order to fund the operation, which is a very expensive operation to fund. How do you reconcile those two things?
Well, it as Maren talked about, I mean, it's vital that we are serving the whole community. And yes, it's pricey. It can be expensive. And at the same time, think about our student tickets, very accessible for someone to come to the BSO for $10. The children who are involved in ORC Kids are doing this at essentially no cost. And it is maybe some of those children are going to end up becoming professional musicians. But regardless of that, this is helping to support their development. It's helping to support student achievement. It helps to support their cognitive development. That is central to our mission in being relevant and serving the community. And if we don't do those things, if we are talking with someone, inviting them to make a philanthropic commitment, I think they may be asking us, well, are you really taking the right steps to serve the community? The lens that we look through is, how are we providing service to the community? And certainly, as an orchestra that has national and international prominence, it's one of the best orchestras in the world, we want to help elevate the visibility of the city, but we also need to make sure that we're really serving all of the people in our community. And ORC Kids is one of the few programs in the country, maybe the only one, that is really doing what it is and serving a very diverse group of young people. We can build on that and expand our focus on diversity and inclusion. This is something that we are working on now in collaboration with the Sphinx organization, and you're going to be hearing more about in the coming months.
They're based in Chicago.
Based in Detroit. That's helping a number of arts organizations to foster diversity and inclusion. Extremely important to us. You're going to be hearing more about that. We're going to be expanding our efforts, which are already significant and already known nationally compared to our peers. We're really proud of what we're doing.
Mm-hmm. We should mention also that we have a tremendous advantage here in Baltimore, also having one of the leading conservatories right at our doorstep with Peabody Institute. And we're in broad discussions, philosophical and practical discussions also with Peabody about how we can partner to create, you know, this pathway for young people. But again, it's not
a pathway into careers as professional musicians.
Or as teachers. Mm-hmm. But, you know, again, our goal isn't to turn everyone into a professional musician, but our goal is to enable everyone to have that transformative life experience through art and through music, you know, of feeling elevated, feeling emotionally connected to something, feeling that you can express your innermost feelings somehow. So, you know, that's the purpose of art in our society, and that's our responsibility.
Baltimore Symphony Orchestra Music Director Maren Alsop and BSO President and CEO Peter Chomey are my guests today. We'll have more of Midday on Music after a quick break. You are welcome to join us on the phone, 410-662-8780. If you have one of those computer things, and our director and engineer Katie Marquette tells me all the young people have one, you can send us an email. This also works for those of you who wish to eschew personal interaction at any cost. Midday at WIPR.org. You can find us in the Twittersphere where we live night and day at Midday Tom Hall. And we are also streaming live on the Facebook. So as we go out, here's some music of Ravel with the BSO and some of the kids from ORCIDS, the education program we've been talking a little bit about. That's the BSO's acclaimed program. This is part of Ravel's Bolero. We'll be back in a flash.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Music of Maurice Ravel, La Valse, the Waltz. Another one of the selections on the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra's concerts this week. And by the way, coming up a little later today, theater critic J. Wynn Russick will review the current show at Baltimore's Vagabond Players. And coming up on Midday Monday, we'll be marking the birthday of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. as we begin the 50th anniversary of the year in which Dr. King was assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee. Joining us to discuss Dr. King's legacy will be the Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Taylor Branch, along with Charles Cobb Jr., a former field secretary in the 1960s with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, plus a man with a very unique perspective on Dr. King, Nelson Mauldin. He was Dr. King's barber back in the day in Alabama. If you're just joining us today, it's Midday on Music with Maren Alsop, the acclaimed music director of the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra, and Peter Chomey, who came to Baltimore last February from Grand Rapids, Michigan, to become the BSO's president and CEO. The BSO is one of 1,600 orchestras in the United States, but the number of those ensembles who operate full-time on a 52-week schedule like the BSO is only about 17. And the BSO is also in the 2% of orchestras whose annual operating budget is above $20 million a year. The annual budget of the BSO is about $28 million, on par with orchestras in Seattle, Detroit, and Indianapolis. The largest budget for an American orchestra, the Los Angeles Philharmonic, which clocks in at a whopping $120 million a year. To join our conversation with Maren Alsop and Peter Chomey, 410-662-8780, our email midday at WIPR.org, and our Twitter handle at Midday Tom Hall. And we are also streaming on the WIPR Facebook page. So, Peter, let's talk about this money thing. $28 million is a lot of money for anybody to have to raise, and sort of the 1st of September comes along for the BSO, and you got to start at zero and get to $28 million by the end of August the following year. The impact of the tax bill that was just passed by Republicans right before Christmas, which is said to be a great disincentive for a lot of people to itemize deductions, which may end up being a disincentive for people to make charitable contributions. Are you concerned about that? What are your thoughts about how that might impact revenue at places like the BSO?
Well, that's certainly something we're looking at very closely, and it's very early in the process to fully understand that. Conversations that I'm having right now is that there may be donors of a certain level that this will have an impact, and at the same time, as we talk about the value of the BSO to our community, they still want to help. there are some of the BSO's closest friends, as we've been talking about their individual situation, where there may be aspects of the tax bill that are actually beneficial for them, where we may be able to see, you know, even some tax advantage. So there's going to be a mix and impacts of donors at different levels, and that's something we're studying very closely. I don't anticipate at this point that it's going to have a major impact on us, but it is something that we are concerned about.
Because the concern that I hear from a lot of folks with nonprofits is that it's not the big donors that are the problem. It's the people who are giving $50, $100, $200 a year. They're not perhaps giving a total of $24,000 to charity, and the cost of their property taxes and stuff may not reach that $24,000 threshold, which is now the standard deduction. So I do you have a sense from people who don't give a lot of money but are in that lower echelon, that the tax incentive is a big reason for giving, as opposed to they support the mission of the BSO?
Yeah, for some people, the tax incentive is an important part of it. And as we think about all the different reasons somebody gives, there are some who are purely giving because they love the music. Perhaps they played an instrument when they were growing up, and they feel that it's important, and it's a principled decision, and that's just simply what they must do. There are others who might be thinking about some of the great benefits that the BSO offers if they make a contribution, and there may be maybe reasons like that that somebody is giving. And so there's a real mix of reasons. The incentive of somebody to give when they're feeling just that it is important, that the BSO is a vital community asset, that they know that we depend on them to sustain and advance the institution, I think that is strong enough that we will overcome those tax incentives. But will there be some people who may give a bit less because of the tax bill change? That's certainly possible, but I think there may be others who will step up and do even more. I think about some of the conversations with donors back during the depths of the financial crisis. We said, you know, we could really use your additional help right now because of what's happening in the country. And people then gave even more. So I think that there's going to be a lot of variation, but I also am very optimistic about the future.
Mm-hmm. And Maren, when I talk to my friends in the orchestra, and of course I was, you know, with the Choral Arts Society for 35 years and work with members of the BSO for that entire time, I'm encouraged by their mood at the moment. In these last few weeks, when I talk to folks, they say things are going well, the orchestra's sounding good, they're encouraged by the job that the board is doing, raising money. There's some hiring going on, you're attracting some young mm-hmm. players. And it's interesting that a few of them have said, you know, we're sort of getting back to basics. We're focusing on excellence, on artistic excellence, in a way that hasn't been the focus, perhaps, in years past. But when people were worrying about this relevance thing, were worrying about how to, you know, make the case for the orchestra, because for a while that was a standard meme in the arts and in music, that excellence wasn't enough. It was, you know, being part of the community in ways that were above and beyond whether you play well or not. Would you agree with that assessment? I mean, are we getting back to basics and focusing on playing? And is that the best way to pitch this to audience members and donors?
Well, I suppose I see it a little bit differently, in that I don't feel that artistic excellence and connecting with community are mutually exclusive. I feel that they go hand in hand, actually, and that the more connection one has, the deeper a relationship you're building and the more understanding you have from the community about what you're doing. So their appreciation of the level of artistic excellence really grows. I think for the 10 years that we've been working together, it's been definitely a steady climb to our current level of artistic excellence, which is, I think, now being recognized internationally, nationally. Mm-hmm. And, I think that's a good harbinger, though, what you're talking about anecdotally from friends in the orchestra, because it means that they're more relaxed, you know, that they're not worried quite so much, which I think enables them to focus more on their playing and not worry about job security and how viable the orchestra is. But here in Baltimore, I have to say that we have one of the world's great, great orchestras. It's a treasure that many people don't know about. And that's our mission, I think, is not only to have artistic excellence, but to share it with our community. Because, again, for me, they go hand in hand.
We have a comment from Facebook. Jeffrey writes in, would be nice to see more engagement with the public and donors from Northern Maryland and Southern Pennsylvania. Any plans for that? Peter, you want to respond?
Well, we certainly want to serve our broader state, and we have been looking at opportunities to go, you know, beyond where we are today, serving Baltimore, Baltimore County, Montgomery County, and other parts of the state. So that's we appreciate that comment and want to broaden our geographic footprint.
What is the status of contract negotiations with the players? Barbara Bizzuto, who was the board chair, is still the board chair, I guess, of the orchestra. Sort of was the acting CEO for a while before you came on board, was able to negotiate a one-year deal. That deal is up, and I guess you're in negotiations at this point. Are you optimistic about reaching an agreement?
And I want to, before I answer that question, just mention that Barbara Bizzuto has now signed up for another 2 years as chair, which we are thrilled about. And she did it all during that transition period of serving as chair and as CEO. And so I arrived in February, and we were very pleased to reach agreement within about 3 months of my arrival early on a new one-year contract with our musicians. Their leadership in working with us to reach agreement early is something I very much appreciate. And we're in discussions now about the next contract. And certainly we would seek, if we can, a multi-year contract. But the spirit of goodwill has been very, very strong. And that makes me optimistic that we will reach another agreement.
And Maren, one of the sticking points in orchestra contracts around the country is the size of the band, the number of players in the orchestra. As I mentioned, there are only 17 orchestras that are now full-time. That's down from 20-something.
Actually, I think it's
ago.
Down even further. I think it's down to 14 now.
Is it?
Believe it or not.
Yeah. I think so. I wondered if that were the case,
so
and
it's
I couldn't.
Small,
couldn't
it's,
yeah.
Yeah.
So the number of orchestras that employ people for 52 weeks a year is dwindling. That's a trend. And one of the arguments is we don't need a full-time orchestra. We need a core of players that can then be augmented by more players when we need them for larger pieces or when we need them at times of the year where there is, in fact, a need. But when there isn't a need in months like August or times that tend to be kind of flat when it comes to the performing arts, that it's not cost-effective to hire people for all 52 weeks. What is the case for having an orchestra that consists of players who are working there as a full-time profession?
Well, you know, we're fortunate to have some wonderful musicians who live in this area who are able to come in as substitute members, and we value their contribution enormously, and they make up a good percentage of our orchestra every week, of course. But there really is no substitute for having full-time members that perform and work together. And, you know, you develop it's like any kind of relationship, you know, you develop an understanding and a nonverbal communication. And, you know, the sound, they contribute so much to the quality of sound, the rhythmic integrity of the orchestra. So I don't think there is an argument. There really is no comparison, I think, between having full-time members and having just supplemental musicians come in, even though the substitute members, their quality is very, very high. But having that day-in, day-out ability. So, I mean, there's no doubt that, you know, and I don't make a secret, of course, of wanting to have the largest number possible. But I think we've found we've managed to come to a place, I think, where we've done as much balancing as we can to serve the needs of the budget and our artistic needs. And I can't say enough about all the musicians that play with the BSO, not just the full-time members, but the substitutes also, because they're part of the family now. And, you know, listen, you know, let's see what the future brings. You know, we all are working very, very hard to sustain this orchestra for many generations to come.
you know, you do have orchestras in Atlanta, Philadelphia, mm-hmm. Indianapolis, who have shrunk in size over the last several years. So there's that precedent. I mean, are the players making a point about so-called parody with orchestras that are like the symphony, the Baltimore Symphony? I mean, I mentioned a few in the introduction to this segment, and they're similar only in that the budget size is about the same. And there's wide disagreement about whether they're artistically similar. But is that an issue as you're carving out an agreement?
Well, we certainly compare ourselves to other orchestras. I want to say, we are, the BSO is one of the best orchestras in the world. And our city does have its problems, but Baltimore is a world-class city, and the BSO is a central importance to the cultural life of the state of Maryland. And so as we're thinking about what we need to put in place for the future, we want to sustain our orchestra at that level. And being a 52-week orchestra is an important part of that. And we certainly are having conversations about the size of the complement and the number of full-time players. As Maren said, we have some marvelous players who come in and play with us on a substitute basis. And at the same time, you know, we are looking to the future. What we need to do is have our artistic plan be very closely linked with the business plan. And, you know, I was a professional oboist years ago, as you know, Tom. And I care very, very deeply about the art and what is happening on stage, and also know that underneath it all, we're a business, and we need to have both. And we're working on our new strategic plan now. We're going to be putting a new 5-year strategic plan in place, and it will be vital to have those artistic aspirations led by Maren outlined in that plan, but then underneath it all, have the sustainable financial plan to make all that happen.
So, Maren, we talked about ORCHIDS, a project that's near and dear to your heart and one that you launched several years ago. We have a comment from Facebook from Bruce, who says, tell us something about the BSO Academy for Adults, so your education and experiential stuff doesn't stay limited to children.
Well, this is a... thank you for asking about this. Is it Bruce?
Bruce. Mm-hmm.
Appreciate it. Our interest in connecting and being a resource is not limited to wanting to serve young people. I was reading statistics about the dwindling ticket sales for the arts, for concerts, for museums, etc. And then there was this interesting statistic that, however, the number of people playing musical instruments has doubled. And I thought, oh, that's so interesting. Well, why aren't they coming to the concerts, and where are they? And we happen to have a free service, and I suggested to the musicians that why don't we open it up and see if there are some non-professional adult musicians. And we called it Rusty Musicians at first. And
Rusty, because he used to play as kids, they, and they aren't playing so much now. Now they're working in other professions.
Exactly right. Yeah. And you know, we didn't know what the response would be, but for that first outing, we had 400 people sign up within 24 hours. So we realized, wow, this could be very, very interesting. And it really caught on, and the musicians have taken it on board and really spearhead the whole thing, and they're marvelous. And, you know, it brings out, I think, the best in our musicians, too, because they love to mentor colleagues and adults and their peers. And that then morphed into the BSO Academy, which is the only thing I can think of it as an analogy is it's like a summer fantasy camp, except for
the
musicians.
Orioles have one for baseball.
Why not?
Yeah, right. Here's an email from Mark. Peter, this is an interesting comment. Every concert begins with a stern warning. No pictures, no recordings, no phones. In an era where most things... Or he says, in an era where things almost don't exist if they're not on social media, the BSO is making an outlaw of my parents who post on Facebook every time they bring the grandkids to a concert. Lighten up, says Mark in this email. You know, this whole thing of the interwebs is a new frontier, or, you know, an evolving frontier for professional symphony orchestras. What about that, social media and spreading the word?
You know, I think Mark makes a very good point, frankly. And several of our musicians and I were talking about this just yesterday, and we have some national media agreements that we need to comply with and follow, but there's one being negotiated now, and we're going to be sharing our point of view that we want to get out there more. We want, of course, we want to be on social media, and we do have an active Facebook page, Tom. So I encourage folks to go and check that out, even if they weren't able to take a picture during the concert. So I think Mark makes a great point.
Or if they did take a picture and you never heard about it.
No, but wouldn't it be fun to start the concert by saying,
go
take
ahead.
Out your phones.
Take out your phones, everybody.
Take some pictures.
Just snap
and
a
post
shot.
It up.
Why not? Absolutely.
So, but a lot of hurdles until we get to that. But let's look forward to it.
Dennis in Otterbein writes on email, I was at last night's BSO concert and thought that the glass timpani concerto was fantastic and truly exhibited the virtuosity of the BSO principal timpanist. That's
James Wyman.
Kudos to his partner from the NSO as well. This is now my second favorite timpani piece after Poulenc's timpani and organ piece. So you have a fan in Dennis and Otterbein.
Awesome.
There is, we just got a minute left here, but Maren, because of social media, because so many things exist in social media, is this a new frontier for symphony orchestras? Is this something, social media is something that can be used in new and exciting ways, looking forward?
Oh, I definitely think so. I mean, you know, my dream really is to sort of have an embedded camera in the orchestra so people could come and join us at rehearsals and feel as though they're sitting inside the orchestra. And, you know, maybe we'll be able to achieve that dream one of these days.
I've been inside an orchestra, too. I got to tell everybody, it's a scary place.
It's scary. No, but it's fun, isn't
Beware.
It?
It is fun. It is fun. All right. Well, Peter Chomey, welcome to town, and thanks for coming over. And Maren, break a leg this weekend. It's
good
to see you.
Great to see you, Tom.
Peter Chomey is the president and CEO of the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra. Maren Alsop is the music director of the BSO. She also leads the Sao Paulo Symphony in Brazil, and she conducts orchestras all over the world. She is, to state it mildly, a frequent flyer. This weekend, she won't have to fly any further than the Meyerhoff in Baltimore and Strathmore Hall in Bethesda tonight, and Strathmore and tomorrow here in Baltimore. She'll be conducting Impressionist masterworks accompanied by projections of French art from the Baltimore Museum of Art. Do I have that right?
Correct.
You're in Strathmore tonight?
Here in Baltimore tomorrow night at 7, and Strathmore Sunday afternoon with the whole program.
There you go. So those performances are part of the BSO's Off the Cuff series. Sunday at Strathmore, French music, again, along with Saint-Saëns' Carnival of the Animals and hip-hop artist Wordsmith, as well as music for two timpanists and orchestra by Phil Glass. Come to our website, wypr.org/midday, and we'll give you all the details about the concerts this weekend. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up after a quick break, theater critic J. Wynn Russick has a review of Inherit the Wind at the Vagabond Players. We'll take you to a break with another taste of Maren Alsop and the BSO. This is music of Mark O'Connor. Stay with us.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.